Welcome again, I suppose, to the LSE. Many people will have said that already today. So this is a short taster lecture on behalf of the Department of Government. I will talk you through some of the things I'm interested in research-wise, but these are also lecture slides that I would use in an undergraduate course as well. So I think you get a pretty good feeling both what I'm interested in and also what you could expect in a lecture at the LSE. Obviously, this is going to be short. I mean, we have 40, 45 minutes overall, so I will probably talk for not more than 20 minutes, so there will be plenty of time for questions. Also, you can interrupt me at any time. So if you feel that you don't understand something or if you want to kind of make a comment, please feel free to, you know, give me a signal and we can stop. I should say a few things about myself. So my name is Kai Spiekermann. I'm a lecturer for political philosophy in the Department of Government. So political philosophy is my main area, but that is rather broadly conceived. So I do a lot of different stuff. And again, if you're interested, I can talk much more about that perhaps later on in the Q&A. And over here is Hannah Wood, who is our brilliant undergraduate administrator. So whenever I don't know how things work here at the LSE, I mean, Hannah will know. I'm absolutely certain she will know. So she will help me out here when the questions become too difficult. Okay, there should be a handout. The handout is not absolutely essential, but if you haven't received it, I mean, here's one more. It should be going around. This is really just a collection of the most important slides. So if you don't have it in front of you right now, don't worry. Okay. So let's get going. So this is a lecture about climate change and the tragedy of the commons. So here is the program for the next 20 minutes. I will give you a mini briefing of what climate change is, and I have the suspicion that most of you will have heard about this before, so I can be rather succinct in that section. I will say something about the so-called tragedy of the commons, so I will introduce a new concept, and then in the third section, I will argue that climate change is actually a large-scale tragedy of the commons, and we can debate what exactly this means for this very difficult, very hard problem. Okay, so here we go. Climate change in a mini nutshell. So if we want to talk about climate change, we need to talk about the overall energy balance of the Earth. So we have sunlight coming in up here, and we have some sunlight being reflected, going back into space. And then we have some other sunlight that actually gets absorbed, like for instance here on the ground, or absorbed in the atmosphere. And this absorbed light is turned into heat. And this heat needs to escape the atmosphere if we want to balance the overall story. So we have, to be precise, 342 watts per square meter coming in. Some of that is leaving full light, and the rest is leaving as heat. The story starts here when we talk about climate change. Here in the atmosphere where we have various greenhouse gases, in particular carbon dioxide, CO2, but also just clouds and methane and a few other greenhouse gases. So these greenhouse gases have an effect. And in particular, they have the effect that some of the heat that is coming up from the surface of the Earth gets absorbed again by these greenhouse gases, and so is then directed back to the Earth. And if you have too many of these greenhouse gases here, then too much heat will get trapped and the Earth will warm. So the balance that you see here, overall incoming energy, outgoing energy, is no longer given, and with this balance no longer given, then we have a heating effect. Now, it's important to notice that this, as such, is not an unnatural process. So if there weren't any greenhouse gases here, if there wasn't anything here, no clouds and so on, and not a certain level of CO2, then actually the Earth would be really, really cold, something like -5, -6 degrees. So the current level of +15 degrees Celsius, that is largely due to kind of a natural greenhouse gas effect that we have experienced, that the Earth has experienced for a long, long, long time. The problem is we put in too much more greenhouse gas. And you can see that here. So this is observations of CO2 concentrations as measured on a mountain in, I think in Hawaii actually, yes, the Mauna Loa, unfortunately, this was measured from around the 1970s until today, and you can see that the concentration of CO2 particles goes up and goes up and goes up and goes up. There's a small seasonal variation. You see the zigzag here, but the overall trend, of course, is very clear. It's going up and up and up. This is measured actually in parts per million. So we have many more CO2 molecules now in the atmosphere than we used to have. The pre-industrial level was something like 280 parts per million. Now we're approaching something like, well, we're pretty close to 400 actually. What happens? Well, what happens is what we expect given the physical effect that I just described. So we have a warming effect. Here you see a number of observations. They are provided by the International Panel on Climate Change. Here you see global average surface temperatures. This is a very well confirmed number. So if you compare surface temperatures from, say, 1850 to, well, recent times, then you see a warming of up to 0.9 degrees or so. And that has been confirmed not only by the IPCC, but by many independent studies. So that is a very, very stable result. We also see some rising of the sea levels. That is mainly due to the effect that the warming actually heats up the water and the water expands in the seas. And once the water expands, then the sea levels start rising. A little bit is also due to melting glaciers and melting ice caps and so on, but so far it's mainly actually the expanding effect that is driving the sea level rise. And you can also see that snow cover in the northern hemisphere is, well, at least gradually going down. The trend here is not quite so clear, and snow cover, of course, is also partly due to the level of precipitation, which might well increase with climate change, but overall, snow cover is going down. So these are the observations of climate change so far. Now, what's going to happen in the future? Here are a few scenarios. They are provided again by the IPCC. So in the left panel here, you see several emission scenarios. So the kinds of emission causes, and this is measured in gigatons of CO2, I mean absolutely massive numbers of CO2, and equivalent gas, actually, EQ. And they describe several scenarios here. So here we have, for instance, a scenario where we are really, really good about controlling emissions, and they actually start going down until 2100. You have other scenarios, more business as usual scenarios, where actually the emissions really go up. And then you have, on the right-hand side, the corresponding temperature increases that are predicted. So, for instance, a business as usual scenario might go well up to 3 degrees or so. And there is considerable uncertainty about these increases. So you see that here in these confidence intervals. So it might also be something like 5.5 or even 6 degrees. But if you're really lucky, it might also be lower. There is quite a fair bit of uncertainty about these predictions still, because these are models, and models always, of course, come with certain caveats. Incidentally, here, the pink line here is not really something that should make us too optimistic. This is the line of what would happen if we would just stop emitting CO2 right now, something that we cannot really do. And even then, I'll be locked in for at least a small temperature increase. So we should expect quite a serious amount of warming. So 2 degrees is perhaps still manageable, but already quite difficult. Will come with changing weather patterns and effects on agriculture, food production, very strong effects probably on those countries that are most vulnerable already, countries with low sea levels, like lying on low sea levels, like Bangladesh, or countries in Africa where agriculture will be particularly badly affected. So this is a very serious matter, even if we can control it up to a degree. All right, so this was the mini briefing of what climate change is. Maybe I should stop for a second and see whether there are questions. No? Everyone's still with me. Great. So let's talk about the tragedy of the comets. So this is the more kind of model-building, analytical part of the talk. The tragedy of the comets is a bit of a toy model that was introduced in a rather funny paper published a long time ago by Garrett Hardin in 1968. It's one of those papers that would probably have been forgotten a long time ago if it wasn't for this particular toy model that he describes. It's really just a few sentences, I've quoted a few here. So he says, "Picture a pasture open to all. It is to be expected that each herdsman will try to keep as many cattle as possible on the commons. Each man is locked into a system that compels him to increase his herd without limit in a world that is limited. So yes, this is a dilemma that Hardy is describing here. He says, well, you have something that is open to all, a commons, and people can use this commons. They can, say, send their cows on that commons. And what happens, everyone is trying to overuse this. And because they're trying to overuse it, it's actually going to get damaged and ultimately destroyed. I will argue today that this structure that Hardin is describing here is exactly the kind of structure that we see when we think about the problem of climate change and emissions with humans. Now, in order to make sense out of this tragedy of the commons, we need to understand another concept, and that is the concept of common pool resources. So what's a common pool resource? It's actually best to understand a common pool resource by thinking about what it is not. So what I'm doing here is I have a little table for you, a 2x2 table with two different dimensions. So we're now thinking about various goods that we can encounter. So there are goods where you can exclude people from using them, where you have an exclusion option. And there are goods where you can't exclude people from using them. And then there are goods that have rivalry in use. So these are goods where if one person uses it, there will be less left for any other person using it. And there are other goods where you don't have rivalry, where it just doesn't matter how many people use it, it will be just as good to use for everyone. So let's think about a few examples. So perhaps private goods first. So for instance, my lunch today, that was a private good. So that was bowl of rice and tofu from Wasabi next door. So that's a private good because I have successfully excluded other people from eating it, so I carried it into my office, so no one was actually able to eat that good, and only I can eat it. So once I've eaten it, it's not really available for anyone anymore, so there's very strong rivalry here. There are club goods. These are goods that are relatively good to use for many people. So think about, say, a golf club or so. So you can have quite a few people using it. Obviously, there might be crowding effects at some point, but in principle, many people can use it. And it's possible to, say, build a fence around it, protect it somehow. So these are club goods. Most interesting for us are public goods and common pool resources. So a public good is given if you can't exclude people, but there's no rivalry in use. A common pool resource is given if you can't exclude people, but actually the use of some people makes this good less available for others. So what are good examples for public goods? Well, national defense. I mean, once you defend the country, you defend the country for everyone. You can't say, well, except for Mr. Smith in King Street, I'm not going to defend the country for that person. That's not going to work. A free radio is also an example for a public good. So once the radio waves are in the air, it's very, very difficult to exclude people. Obviously, TV licensing is partly about trying to do that. With all the empirical problems that you can discuss here. But now let's finally turn to common pool resources, because these are the most interesting ones for us. So these are goods where actually the use of others makes a difference. So maybe let's take the second example here. Let's consider a lake, a big lake with fishers around that lake, and they're all kind of living off this lake, and they're taking fish out of that lake. Now clearly it's the case, it's quite difficult to stop those different fishers actually using that lake. They all sit around this lake there, and let's say they're on property around that lake, so it's really, really hard to control how much fish is taken out of that lake. At the same time, if a fisher takes out too much fish, or if many fishers do that, then ultimately that resource will be depleted. Maybe to the extent that the stocks can't even recover. That would be really bad. So that is a classical example for a common pool resource. Different examples could be some kind of wood that is used jointly where people can take out timber, and if they take too much, then the wood gets destroyed. Or the commons, I mean, these are the cows grazing. So these are all common pool resources. All right, everyone with me about common pool resources? Great. Okay, let's get a little toy model on the wall. So this is a really, really simple tragedy of the commons problem. It only has two actors and a very simple good. So we have two farmers, And these two farmers can make a decision. They can either send one or two of their cows to graze on the commons. Let's suppose that each cow provides a benefit to a farmer. Let's say this benefit is 10 pounds. Numbers are small, you could multiply them by any number you want. If you want to have it more realistic, doesn't matter. Smaller numbers are just easier to deal with. Now let's assume that two of your cows can just live off the commons without buying any further feed, and the commons don't get damaged. However, when you send three cows on the commons altogether, then the commons are partly damaged, and the farmers will need to buy extra feed. Let's say extra feed of the value of £4 per cow. If there are four cows on the commons, things get even worse, so then the commons get severely damaged, and then they need to buy quite a lot of extra feed for these cows, to the value of £6 per cow. And now we can start calculating what happens. So we have a little game, if you want. So this is a very simple game theory. We have one farmer who can decide to send one cow or two cows, and another farmer who decides to send one cow or send two cows. And the first number in the cells in this table always represents the payoff for farmer number one, and the second number represents the payoff for farmer number two. So what happens if they both send one cow? No damage to the commons, they get the benefit of £10, so they both get 10. So far, so good. Now farmer number one starts thinking, as always, where the danger comes in. So farmer number one starts thinking, and he kind of thinks, if I send two cows, I get £20. Okay, I have to buy feed for them. That is 2 times £4, but overall, then I have £12. So that's better than £10. So I send two cows. So now we have three cows on the commons. And the second farmer who only sends one cow, he will get 6. So £10 minus £4. Then the other farmer starts thinking as well. What happens? Well, ultimately, they end up down here. Each of them is going to send two cows to the commons. The commons get damaged, they have to buy the extra feed. And to make matters even worse, they only get £8 each, rather than the £10 that they could have had if they both had sent one cow. By the way, do you see a way to avoid this problem? Is there something that these farmers could do? Yes. Talk to each other would be a first step. It's tricky though. I mean, talking alone would probably not solve the problem. What they would really need is some kind of contract, an enforceable contract, really a contract that would force both of them to only send one cow. Without a proper enforcement mechanism, things get really complicated here. It's very unlikely that they can extract themselves from that. Because see that no matter what the other farmer does, it's always better to send the extra cow. If the other farmer already sends two cows, then you don't want to be the poor guy who gets 6. So then you rather get 8, so you send your extra cow as well. And if the other farmer is not sending two cows, then it's still better to benefit and go from 10 to 12. So no matter what the other guy does, it's always better to send two cows. That's the dilemma here. That's the question.
Sharing three cows?
Sharing three cows. Actually, it would be better to have just two cows, because have a look at what happens with three cows. There you have an overall benefit of 18. Mm-hmm. Well, with two cows, only you have a benefit of 20. Actually, it would be even better. The idea is the right one, but it would be even better to just restrict it to two cows. Absolutely right. Okay, I think you've seen the nature of this dilemma here. So, final step in this whole thing, and then I open up to more questions. I should now convince you that climate change is a very similar sort of problem. So, why is the absorptive capacity of the atmosphere a similar problem? Well, because it meets our two criteria for common pool resources. So, we have non-excludability. It's almost impossible to prevent people from emitting CO2 and other greenhouse gases. Secondly, there's clearly rivalry. So the more people use the atmosphere as a sink for carbon and other greenhouse gases, the more dangerous it becomes to emit even more, and ultimately the storage capacity, I mean the safe storage capacity of the atmosphere, will be depleted. And when that happens, well, then we have a problem. Also, very similar to the kind of small-scale commons example that we discussed, the problem is not so much any use, the problem is the overuse. So the atmosphere would be able to recover from some extra emissions, just the amount of extra emissions that makes the problem so severe. So this massive overuse, that's the issue. By the way, how large are our commons if we consider climate change? So in order to answer that question, I found a really, really clever way of accounting for that in one of the leading science magazines called called Nature. So this is a graph that shows you on the x-axis the total number of CO2 emissions from 2000 to 2050. So if you want the overall budget that we have in terms of emissions. And on the y-axis, it shows you the probability of exceeding a warming of 2 degrees centigrade, which is by many scientists considered as something like a relatively safe threshold. If you go above 2 degrees, then many people agree we will have a real big problem. And you can see the more is emitted in total in this whole time period between 2000 and 2050, the more likely it becomes that we exceed this maximum threshold of 2 degrees and we want to stay under 2 degrees. Now, you see this is a relatively kind of big band of various models here. So obviously, these predictions are difficult. So these are various computation models that try to predict how the relationship is. But you can see the overall trend. Obviously, the more you emit, the more likely it is that we are going to exceed this 2 degrees threshold. Now, the interesting thing here is that we have so much of the carbon dioxide, or rather the carbon, left that we can burn. So here we have our known gas reserves, here we have our known oil reserves, here we have our known coal reserves, and these are the total proven fossil fuel reserves. And you can see, if we burn all the fossil fuels that we know of right now, then we easily go into this area here, and we are almost certainly going to hit the 2 degrees threshold. So the challenge here really is to cut back here and somehow come to, well, a sort of agreement that allows us to leave some of these resources that of course are attractive to burn because you can produce energy and you can produce goods and so on, to leave some of these resources in the ground. That, I think, certainly is a tragedy of the commons-like problem. Just because, well, on the one hand, it's attractive as an individual actor or as an individual state to use these extra resources and burn them. But on the other hand, if everyone does that, that will be a complete disaster. We end up somewhere here, and we will have a very severe, potentially catastrophic climate change. So really, we have a massive tragedy of the commons problem here. Why is this problem particularly hard? Well, just very briefly, we're talking about very large groups here. So we're not talking about two farmers who can perhaps make a contract or something like that. Finding a global deal is very challenging because so many actors are involved, and many of them have very different interests. So some actors are developing countries and they really want to grow and they need a lot of energy. Other actors will be much more threatened by climate change and really want to take immediate action now, so it makes it really hard to come to an agreement. Considering this on the kind of non-state level, but more on the individual level, there is anonymity. So you have insufficient control over what people are actually emitting. It's very hard to account for all of that. The resource is not valued equally by everyone. So as I said, some countries really fear any kind of warming. So if you live on, say, Tuvalu, and I mean, even a moderate rise in sea levels is a disaster for you, then of course you want to stop right now. But if you say Russia, with, you know, large parts of the land being really, really cold, maybe a little bit of global warming is not so bad after all. Yeah, I mean, seriously, I mean, these people are they're thinking about that. That's an issue. Then we have still an unclear link between the causal, between behavior and the causal impact. So while we understand climate change relatively well, we don't understand it super well. We still don't know exactly how big the effects will be. There's very little initial trust in these global negotiations. Monitoring and sanctioning is extremely costly. We have unstable resource prices in the sense that not burning carbon is not really rewarded very much. There are a few attempts to pay people for saving in terms of emissions. For instance, the European trading system is the largest attempt to do that, but the prices in that system have collapsed right now, so actually not emitting carbon dioxide is not really rewarded very highly. So that's another problem. So we need to fix this as well. And many, many more problems. So this is indeed a hard problem. So let me conclude. I said that common pool resources are non-excludable goods with rivalry. Their use often leads to a tragedy of the commons. I argued that the absorptive capacity of the atmosphere is precisely such a good, and right now we are actually observing a tragedy of the commons on a really, really large scale, and we need to think very hard how we can solve that problem. That's the taster lecture, and now there's plenty of time for questions. Yes?
Isn't the geological evidence that the Earth's constantly gone through periods of, you know, heating up and cooling down anyway, you know, naturally? And also, a lot of gases are emitted through volcanic action and always have been.
Yes, there is evidence that actually the temperature has gone up and down throughout times. What is new, however, is the speed with which we emit CO2 into the atmosphere. So the big issue really is we are running this absolutely huge-scale experiment that we are, in an unprecedented way, emit a lot of CO2 very quickly into the atmosphere. And that is very likely going to lead to an effect. So even if you are a skeptic about the detailed science, just the amount of emissions that we're currently putting into the atmosphere and the likely physical effect that that will trigger, that is alone, I think, reason enough to be extremely careful and try to limit that effect. So yes, there has been ups and downs, and we also know that the extremely warm periods on the Earth, if we look at the evidence from a really long time ago, they often coincide with very high levels of CO2 into the atmosphere as well. That's another reason to believe that actually emitting CO2 may lead to warming. But you're right, I mean, until around, say, 15, 20 years ago, we could still have believed, well, maybe we're still in this natural cycle. We have these natural cycles of plus half a degree centigrade, minus half a degree centigrade. And that could have been a normal cycle. Now we are outside of that comfort zone already. So there's relatively good evidence that we are already in a man-made climate change situation.
Does the volcanic activity, does that have any impact on?
Oh, yes. Volcanoes can actually cool the Earth. So when we had the Pinatubo, for instance, that cooled the Earth for around 1 to 3 years or so, by about half a degree. So if everything else fails, then maybe we should hope for really strong volcanic activity. But volcanoes actually do matter a lot. There was another question somewhere. Yes, you please.
Within the government department, how do you examine students? Is it purely an examination at the end of the year, or is it course-based?
It's mainly exams-based. So we have, I think, one or two courses now that are changing that. So you also have the chance to, at least in some of the degree programs, to write an extended essay, a long essay, a sort of dissertation, and that will be marked as well. But the main form of examination is exams. Maybe you want to add something to that.
Yeah, we've got two second-year courses that are examined, 75% exam, 25% assessed essay. You submit your assessed essay around this time, around Easter time, sit the exam in the summer. Your overall course mark is obviously a combination of the two. And then, as Kai said, there are two third-year dissertation options now, which are 100% assessed on the dissertation. You don't sit an exam for them.
Yes?
The talking that I mentioned about studying abroad, is it just the opportunity to study in France, or are there places to go to as well?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question. So say again, so you...
For the option to study abroad, notice that it was offered to 10 SC students. Is it only to go to France, or are there other sort of countries to go to as well?
I don't know, but you know. See, that's one of these questions.
The LSE has a formal agreement with Sciences Po to run an exchange scheme where students can go for 1 year. Although the work that you do abroad and the assessment that you take in France doesn't count towards your LSE degree. So, in a sense, it would add on a year to your degree, and the credits would count towards the classification that you graduate with here. Students have rarely arranged other exchanges. formal LSE process, but there have been students who have come to us and said, I've arranged a one-year exchange at this university, would LSE terminate my registration for a year? And that has been possible, but again, the marks that you obtain abroad wouldn't count towards your LSE classification.
Yes, at the back first, please. Yes, you, with the white shirt, yeah.
How is each year final examinations, how are they weighted in terms of your final degree? Is each year worth 33% or is like the final year given a greater percentage of your final mark?
No, it's the case that the first year is worth less. So the first year is discounted a fair bit, while the second and third year are equally important. So in the first year, the expectation is that you can experiment a little bit and that you find your way. It's not completely unimportant, but the nice feature about the first year is that so the lowest mark will be dropped, so it's not quite so important.
You want to?
I think that should answer the question, I think. Yes, I think you had a question as well here, yeah.
Yeah, I did. I'm just going back to the original lecture that you in your final graph, when you presented the link between cumulative CO2 emissions and the amount of fossil fuels left in the ground, are you sort of implying there that you should control the distribution of cows and release of cows instead of actually controlling how CO2 is burnt?
I mean, okay, so I mean, there are various ways of going about this, of course. So, okay, so you're talking about the analogy between the cows and the fossil fuels.
Yeah.
So, I mean, ultimately, the resource, the commons that we're talking about here is the absorptive capacity in the atmosphere. So it's ultimately about pumping CO2 and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So I would say there are several ways of dealing with that. I mean, either you stop burning these fossil fuels. So then we really need some kind of restrictions on how we use fossil fuels. And this could come, of course, in terms of hard restrictions. You really have prohibitions. That is not very likely to work. But more likely to work is a form of tax system, so that eventually burning fossil fuels becomes so expensive that people don't do that anymore, and rather find new alternative forms of energy, such as solar power and so on, and a few other sources of energy. So that's one way of going about it. In principle, of course, you could also think of ways of burning them, but in a cleaner way. So right now people talk a lot about carbon capture and storage. So especially for coal, there is an idea that you could capture the CO2 after burning the coal and pump it into some kind of underground storage places, like, for instance, large caverns or so. The problem with that technology is currently we have no plant working on a large scale, so we don't know whether it's going to work properly. Secondly, it is actually rather inefficient, so we lose at least a quarter of efficiency of these power stations if we do that. But still, I mean, given that there is so much, especially coal, lying around, in particular in those countries that need to develop, like India and China, maybe something like carbon capture and storage is really the way forward. So then, in a way, they are allowed to send their cows to the commons, but they have to clean up after their cows, if you want to kind of push the analogy further. Yes, over there. Yes, you.
Although very interesting, analogies like this, would we address the actual crises ourselves, or is this merely an introduction to something for further reading? What is the purpose of the talk in the long run?
Mm-hmm.
Without sounding arrogant, I really hope I didn't.
Okay, that's a difficult one, of course. So, I mean, for me, the main purpose of these 20 minutes is to understand the nature of the problem. So to understand that this is, in a way, well known, this is a social dilemma. This is something that political scientists, political philosophers have been thinking about for a very, very long time. What is new is that it's a social dilemma on such a large scale. So I think going back to the original resources, understanding the really simple basic structure, that's really the basic structure. You have to extend it to many, many more persons and make it a little bit more complicated. But the basic dilemma is the same. So once we understand this basic structure, we can start to think about why this particular problem is so hard to solve and how we can transform this problem in kind of helpful ways in order to make it a little bit more tractable. So understanding the basic structure hopefully gives us solutions how we as social scientists can make proposals, how we get around this social dilemma. Of course, I mean, in order to say more about that, we would have to, you know, have a proper long series of lectures now to explore this further. But I hope that understanding the nature of the problem helps us to offer solutions. And that is ultimately what we should do as social scientists.
So these lectures are more like a malleable comprehension that can be applied to other ideas or other crises. So this is a basic understanding.
Oh, yes. I mean, you could say very similar things, for instance, about the depletion of, say, fish stocks or so. So if you think about yellowfin tuna or so, or about many, many other things. So so I'm kind of, if you want, I kind of had a look at the toolbox and said, here is an important tool to understand the nature of such problems. And we can use it to analyze this problem and other problems. But the climate change problem, in my opinion, right now is perhaps the biggest of them all. I saw at least one more question somewhere. Yes, you with the blue shirt.
Yeah, going back to the general course, mm-hmm. I applied for straight government.
Mm-hmm.
And there are quite a lot of urban opportunities for outside options.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, in your experience, which departments the students most love to go into, and how broad exactly are the opportunities in outside options?
Oh, I mean, the LSE is such a diverse place, you have plenty of opportunities. So obviously, there are some departments that are just related with us in terms of what they cover. So, I mean, obviously to mind comes international relations, philosophy, geography, economics, that list is very likely not complete. But you could, of course, also venture out a bit more. That really depends on your interests. And I mean, if you are interested in kind of tailoring your degree, then the government degree is really good for you because, as you say, it gives you a lot of different options. It's, to a certain extent, up to you to explore what will work and what won't work. The nice thing, again, is about the first year you can experiment a little bit and it won't have too much influence for your final classification. So you can really just explore. However, you will be guided by a personal advisor. So there will be an academic and you will have a meeting, I mean, actually, just when you start here, and then you talk through these various options and this advisor will tell you whether this is a good idea or perhaps you should be a little bit careful about a certain option or so. And plenty of opportunities there. Yes?
And for the outside option, are you limited to what you've studied at A level? So could you not do an economics option if you haven't done that?
No, not in principle. Of course, there are certain things that would perhaps be unwise to choose. So if you really hate maths, then I probably wouldn't recommend an economics option. It just would not be a very clever thing to do in that case. But it's not required. Yeah, no, it's not the case that, I mean, in a few departments, and economics is the interesting one here, they sometimes have courses on two different levels, kind of the harder course and the slightly kind of less hard course. And that will depend on your previous qualifications. So that would be details that have to be discussed. But in principle, I mean, your A levels will not put restrictions on the kind of outside options that you can take. Yes?
I've applied for government and economics.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just a completely separate halves of the course, or are they integrated in any way at all?
Well, I mean, they're integrated in terms of the topics that they're interested in. So you will find that there are loads and loads of links. I mean, the courses, of course, are provided by two different departments, but you will find that actually they integrate very nicely. So I would be fairly optimistic that you will perceive this as a very coherent degree. Yes.
In terms of the options, prospectuses from different years have listed comparative politics as in one year a course in itself and another year a set of five options. In the 2012 course, is it a course or is it comparative politics courses which you can choose from, like states, nation and empire?
Ah, this is one of these questions again.
The way those regulations are set out, and I know exactly what you're referring to, it's worded very badly. the aim is that in the second year, when you can select from, you have to pick 4 out of 5 government units. What we're trying to demonstrate is that though all of those units fall under a sort of general umbrella term of comparative politics, there's not a course in its own right that is just called comparative politics. And what you would do from the list, I think it's listed like A to D, and then there's a course that says E, an outside option. The aim is that you would pick from that list A to D which courses you want to study.
Would it be possible to get a comprehensive list for 2012?
Yes, yeah, it's not live yet on the school calendar. But it in fact doesn't change from the 2011-12 regulations. So what is up at the moment on both the departmental website and the school website is exactly correct for next year.
Yes?
And when do we have to choose our options?
You don't have to choose your options before you arrive. It would be wise to have a look at the first year regulations for whatever degree programme you're going to start on and have a think about what you would like to do. When you arrive in Freshers Week, you will come to the departmental orientation meeting, and at that meeting you'll be given an appointment with your personal advisor. In that meeting you will run through what options you think you would like to study. Your advisor will guide you and give you some advice about whether that's a good combination or not. And after that meeting, the personal advisor will approve your course choices for you.
Yes?
If you do a combined degree like politics and philosophy, are you then limited on what you can do outside, or limited on like how many courses within those subjects you can take? So obviously, you'll have two separate.
Yes, that is true to a certain degree. So the politics and philosophy I know quite well, so I'm partly responsible for that. For that degree, actually. So, yes, I mean, there are more restrictions there just because you're trying to put two subjects into one degree. And that will require that certain foundations just have to be laid. So, for instance, in the first year, you don't have much of a choice. You just have to take certain introduction courses. And that makes perfect sense because they prepare you for the second year. At the same time, I think that perhaps this reduced lack of flexibility, of course, also comes with this enormous advantage of having these two really exciting subjects. So I think that's a trade-off. If you have very specific ideas of what you want to do, which very few people actually have before they arrive at the LSE in my experience, but if you had very specific ideas, then maybe you want to choose a more kind of a degree with more freedom in it. But if you say, hey, I really want to do politics and philosophy, I wouldn't worry so much about this flexibility, because the courses that you will take, they will be really good courses, and I think they will challenge you and be interesting, and you will enjoy it even if you don't have that flexibility. Well, that's my view on this one, at least. Yes?
And will our student advisors and department advisors help us if you want to find like internships and work experience?
Up to a point. I mean, maybe you're in a better position to answer.
The Careers Office have various connections in terms of internships, and you can definitely come to the department and ask questions about that and get some advice, but we would most certainly refer you on to the Careers Office. Every department has a representative who works in the Careers Office, and so we have somebody who works to set up government internships for our students and just to advise government students, and they can give you endless advice about the opportunities. Most students take an internship, it's very common.
If there are no more final questions, then I think it's time to proceed to the meet and greet. So we're going to have a meet and greet with further members of the department, so you can then meet more members of staff, and the meet and greet will be upstairs in room 104, I believe.